Hello and welcome to another episode of the Black Business Psychology Network's podcast. My name is Dr. Grace Mansa-Arusu and I'm your host. Today's episode features an international guest. I wish I could actually have flown to Johannesburg in South Africa to actually meet Dr. Rowayne Kok, but couldn't do that. So via Zoom, we managed to do a recording. So as you probably would have heard, today's guest is Dr. Rowayne Kok, who is the founder and CEO of Authentic Organisations, which is an organisation that helps marginalised professionals from protected groups to be able to bring their authentic selves to work. Dr. Kok has a PhD in industrial and organisational psychology from the University of Johannesburg, as well as working in his own consultancy. He's a research associate at the University of Johannesburg, and he also works at the African Leadership University School of Business, teaching leadership to emerging young talent in the African region, which is really fantastic. Dr. Kok's PhD thesis is actually strangely very similar to my PhD thesis, and his thesis was on the construction of an authentic work-related identity amongst Black professionals in South Africa. So stay tuned if you want to hear more about Dr. Kok's journey into industrial and organisational psychology. So if you want to hear more about his journey and his career story, stay tuned.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Black Business Psychology Network's podcast. And today, again, as usual, we have another guest, but today we've gone a little international via Zoom. I'm very upset that I'm not actually in Johannesburg. Like, I'm very upset, but maybe one day we can make it happen. So I'm not going to introduce the guest yet. I'm going to let him introduce himself. So thank you for coming, Dr. Rowayne.
Grace, thank you for the invitation. So my name is Rowayne Kok, and I'm an industrial and organizational psychologist, and I'm based in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Brilliant. Thank you so much again for taking the time out of your busy day to come and talk to us. So first of all, I'd really like to know about your current role. So like, what do you do at the moment? And then I'll go back into the past. But yeah, what's your current role at the moment? Where do you work and where do you reside?
So my current role is the founder and CEO of an organization called Authentic Organizations. And essentially, my business is focused on organizational development consulting, coaching, and learning and development. And so those are the key areas. Our key purpose is around ensuring that particularly marginalized individuals, whether they're professionals or leaders, are able to be their best selves within the context of work. Mm-hmm. And so this is the organization that I founded after completing my PhD in, 2019? And so my PhD was around the authentic work identity of young Black professionals. And this was in a multinational organization and was a case study, ethnographic based. And so a lot of the outcomes, and we can talk a little bit more about that, from my research encouraged me to create an organization that can assist particularly those that feel marginalized, whether you're a racial ethnic group, whether you are LGBTIQ plus people, or whether you, you know, whether it's, and I haven't done much work around disabled people with disabilities. It's certainly something, it's such a specialized area as well, but these are often, particularly within the South African context, are people that are neglected in terms of understanding their minority. You know, you spoke earlier around being a minority in South Africa. As Black people, we are the majority, and yet we are the minority. So there's an interesting dynamic as, you know, what we refer to as the majority-minority in this context. And so it's slightly different to perhaps what you would find in Europe and North America.
Yeah, it's definitely. So it's a very, like you said, it's a unique context. So you've got your own challenges and barriers as well. That sounds fantastic. I will be asking you if I could have a read of your PhD thesis. It sounds similar to mine. Mine was around the career journeys of Black knowledge-intensive workers in the UK. But I mean, I'd have to dust that off because I haven't looked at it for quite some time. But yeah, if you've got any links to your research or if you've got any where it's published or anything, be interested to share and have a read. Actually, it's quite relevant.
In fact, I can do that. But I could also, I've published an article recently which is an autoethnography of my own personal story, which was one of the data points of my PhD as well,
right,
where I talk about how I, the different parts, the different multiple identities that make up who I am,
yeah,
and how I make sense of the stigma associated with being Black. In South Africa, we have a mixed group referred to as colored, which is an apartheid categorization, which is problematic in so many ways.
Yeah.
And also, I'm also a gay man, and how these multiple stigmatizations, so intersect, and how I make sense of that, and my story of transcendence, and how I define who I am within the context of work.
It is so complicated, isn't it? It's so complex because, like you said, people do intersect. You don't just walk around ticking one box and then like, oh, I'm Black all the time, and then 30% of the time I'm a man, and then 30% of the time I'm a gay man. Like, what? It doesn't really work like that. Especially when it comes to things like bringing your full self to work, like, that's not going to be the same for every person that ticks all the same boxes as you. It's a very unique journey. So again, very interested to read that, and then we'll be sharing the links afterwards. So I always ask this story, and everyone always goes like, oh, that's a bit broad, but I love asking about origin stories. So it'll be interesting to find out your pathway to industrial/organizational psychology. So where did you begin, and how did you end up where you are?
So I grew up during apartheid. So I was born during apartheid. I did most of my education during apartheid. I come from a coastal town, and I always refer to it as a small town. It's actually the fifth biggest city in South Africa, so it's not that small, called Port Elizabeth. And right. So that's where I grew up, and my family is from the Eastern Cape of South Africa. Right. When I finished school, I went to the University of the Western Cape, which is based in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And this was late 80s, and so this was really... I suppose we didn't know then that, the end was near, but we, because in 1980s, 1989, I was the first year at the UWC, and this, the university was at the forefront against the fight of apartheid, right? So the our chancellor was Archbishop Tutu, and you had the likes of Professor Jakes Gerwel, and there were all these political names that were associated with the university. And, you know, I remember going to the university. We grew up very protected and shielded from, I suppose, the atrocities of apartheid, where I grew up in the community in Galvandale, which is the northern suburbs of Port Elizabeth. And it's interesting because what happened is that, you know, Black people were put on the outskirts of the city.
Yeah.
And so I grew up there in Galvandale. And when I went to university, I suddenly had access to all of these material that talked about the atrocities, that talked about the heroes. And you know, I knew about Nelson Mandela, but I didn't really know about him. And, you know, the likes of Steve Biko, who was the founder of Black Consciousness, which is an underlying belief and philosophy that I subscribe to. And so this was that first year of formative years really shaped who I became and who I am as an individual and a professional in many ways. You know, to give you an example of a typical kind of, it's not typical day, typical weekend, week, month, whatever that may be. You know, there'll be a rally against some idiotic regulations that the apartheid government would have implemented. And the students would, you know, would start off, you know, in our student center with one of the lead, you know, one of the lecturers, the academics or whoever it may be, may start off at the campus, and we'll get into the buses to this rally where we would protest this. And it would always end up with the police coming back to the campus and tear gassing and helicopters hovering, and you wouldn't sleep that night, you know. So that was frequently what would happen, during those kind of my first undergraduate degree. But it was exhilarating, it was exciting, it was just, but still, you know, very frightening, because, you know, you're dealing with the brutality of the South African police and secret services, and some of the things that we found out many years later. You know, I would not say I was in the forefront of the fight, but I was certainly, you know, part of the struggle in that way. And, you know, it would shape me forever. And after completing my degree, and I did a BCom degree, and so my majors were business economics and industrial psychology. And I didn't have access to a bursary, so I had to take a teaching bursary, which meant that when I finished my degree, I needed to go teach. And what I then decided to do is, my mother's a teacher, my aunts are teachers, and so, you know, this is kind of during apartheid, you were either a teacher, a lawyer, or a doctor. You know, there were no industrial and organizational psychologists as we understand them now. And I then said to my mother and father that I wanted to do an honors degree. I didn't know what honors degree I wanted to do. And I looked at my marks. I thought, oh, I did well in industrial and organizational psychology. So perhaps that's something I should do. And I literally, as I said, I lived in Port Elizabeth, and the university, local university, was then called the University of Port Elizabeth. It's now called the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University. And I literally went to the faculty, knocked on the head of department's door and said, I want to do an honors, and didn't do the application. The application finished the previous year. This was January 1992. And he said, sorry, we don't have any place. The next day I got a call from him and said, oh, well, actually, we do have a place. You could start on Monday or whatever the day was. And I got accepted to industrial psychology. And that's the that year, the honors year, is really where I refined my understanding of industrial and organizational psychology, where I really kind of appreciated what it was all about. Particularly, you know, then I remember very distinctly, you know, that some of the subjects that I really enjoyed was organizational behavior. In fact, consumer behavior was even I always wondered whether, you know, if I pursued that further, what would have happened in terms of, you know, going to marketing or, you know, those other fields. But organizational behavior was one of the subjects that I really, really enjoyed as a, and so in South Africa, you do a 3-year degree, and then you do an honors degree, which is your fourth year. And then, of course, then you do your master's. And so this was an honors degree.
So it was like a one year top up, basically. To get you over the line.
But it was hard because I came from a very liberal university to a conservative university that was predominantly a white university. South Africa, you had white and black universities. And so, and the adjustment to that type of teaching education was really hard. And I remember sitting in the class, and I had, you know, very kind of socialist slants towards work, minimum wage, the unions, the role of the unions. And these lecturers were just totally, you know, very, very conservative. I remember sitting in the class, and one of the lecturers, and we were talking about democracy, and he said, well, democracy is for the devil. And I'm like, what do you mean? You know, and and those were like and I realized that I was working hard, but not getting good grades. And partly because I think it was an adjustment issue, but it was also a philosophical kind of issue around some of these issues. And I then had to decide to toe the line so that I can get through the program.
You just need the grades at that point. And it's
exactly. And so that's my formative years and where I got exposed to industrial psychology. So what I then did is I started working because I had to go work. And so after my honors degree, I told my mother and father that I was not going to do this teaching degree or diploma. And I moved to Johannesburg in 1993. Not having a job, I walked the streets of Johannesburg. Then you could do that in the CBD. And looking for a work, and I found my first job as a graduate a trainee at a fashion retail organization. And that's when I worked there for about 5 years, and I moved into HR, became a regional HR manager. And then I started my master's degree. And so I, from my master's degree in South Africa, then I think it's similar in the UK as well. I then did a one-year internship. I was then at Ernst & Young.
Right.
And my supervisor was one of the, I suppose the, you could almost consider him to be, you know, one of those legends in industrial and organizational psychologists, a gentleman called Professor Theo Feltzman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my supervisor. So I really learned from the best in South Africa. And he was also my master supervisor.
Right.
And so I finished the internship and then registered as a psychologist in about 2002.
Okay.
So yeah, so it's going on almost like 19 years that I've been an industrial organizational psychologist.
You've really earned your stripes, and that journey does sound really interesting, that especially considering like you got a job straight away, you went the HR route, you started the graduate training, then went the HR route, and then pursued the master's after you had a bit of experience behind your belt. How was it working? So after, I think post, when you started the job in the fashion retailer, was that post-apartheid? I think it was, by the sounds of it, if I got the dates right.
Yeah, that would have been 93. So apartheid, yeah. So our first democratic elections was 1994.
Yeah.
And so although that was, you know, the dawn of the democracy in South Africa, and most organizations were still, and to this day, you know, a lot of our corporate organizations are, you know, run by white males.
Yeah.
And so it meant that, you know, that interaction with white people was hard and difficult, because up to the stage where I went to the University of Port Elizabeth, I actually didn't have any white friends. I didn't know any white people before that, because we were segregated. We lived separate from each other.
Yeah.
And so that adjustment was really hard. And so dealing with, so we were two white trainees, two black trainees that started working, and there were eight white trainees, and
right,
you know, as you're engaging with each other and your manager, you suddenly realize that, well, the two of us are gets treated differently. Why is that?
Mm.
And you know, you and of course, because of my educational background, I understand some of the psychology around that.
Yeah.
But what that meant is that we create these strategies as part of my research work that I do as well to cope. And so one of the strategies that I adopted was working really hard to prove myself. And so that's what we sometimes, and a lot of marginalized minorities do in the, you know, in coping with the stigma,
yeah,
whether they within organization or structurally in our society.
Yeah, absolutely. That overworking, pursuit of perfection. Yeah, it can be quite damaging, because you end up, in theory, never being good enough. So then there's something that you need to like work through, not internalize, and do your best. But it's a hard thing to learn, and it's something you would discover. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That sounds really interesting. And also, because I don't know if I want to call you a guinea pig, but you were kind of, by circumstance, you were just born at that particular time and you went through. So you were kind of came out, you've spat out after or during the end of apartheid. So you would have gone into the world of work whilst all these massive social changes were in action. And I can't imagine how it must have been interesting, but also at the time you were in it. So you had to just figure out a way, like you said, head down and work to just get through it and then get to where you needed to be. At the time of you completing the MSc, well, before you finished the master's, but during the world of work, were there any kind of like black or marginalized role models within IO psychology at that time?
I don't recall any. You know, my mentor and my supervisor, as I said, he was a gentleman called Professor Feltzman. And so that's what I looked up to. And so, you know, as we know around this work, is that that's the prototype. And so as we compare ourselves to the prototype, we then fall short, because we don't look like our white colleagues that are in the industry.
Yeah.
Today in South Africa, less than 35% of our IOPs are black. This is 2021, when black people are the majority in South Africa. And that's shocking, that, you know, 20 odd years after, you know, into democracy, 27, 28 years into democracy, that we still find ourselves that the structural inequalities in our societies are preventing one students to get to master's level, when they reach master's level, to do their internships. To give you an example, I'm the executive member and also chair of the transformation portfolio for the Society of Industrial and Organization Psychology, which is SOYOPSA.
Yeah.
And so when we did some research and we went around the universities in the province of Gauteng, mm-hmm. we found 20 unemployed master's graduates that could not get an internship. And guess what? They're all Black. And so structurally, our profession still marginalize those that that are Black. And so what we've done as a SOYOPSA is we created a program where we're now helping 10 of those 20 students through their internships, so that we can create a better diverse pool of IOP psychologists in South Africa.
Yeah, no, that sounds familiar. It sounds familiar, but at least you're counting the numbers. I think in the UK with the Division of Occupational Psychology, there is no official tally of ethnicity of members. Like, that's official members. So we don't even know the numbers. Obviously, they're different numbers to what it would be like in South Africa in terms of ethnicity in general. But because we don't have a starting point, we have no idea really what's going on. And I find that quite telling of people's willingness to want to know. Because if it doesn't affect you, you're not going to want to know, because it's not a problem for you, but it's actually a problem for some people, but it's not a problem for others. In general, the pathway of IO occupational psychology in the UK is quite hazy. It's not as structured as, you know, your clinical and educational, which are funded routes, as well as others that aren't funded like counselling and health. And there's only one in the UK, you can do a professional doctorate in all of the areas of psychology. And but for the other disciplines, there's much more choice. With IO, it's not so much choice. So it's a bit of an interesting situation, but it does sound similar to what's happening in South Africa. And it's interesting, like you spoke about what kind of drew you to IO psychology, which was you felt you were good at it in your first degree and you wanted to see if you could continue to be good in it. It's something you were interested in, it was like a natural affinity, right? In South Africa, would you say in terms of the areas of psychology, the applied areas, is there a leaning towards one area more so than the other? Do you have any idea of that?
In psychology generally?
Yes.
Yeah. So similar, the parallels are very similar. So there's, I never thought of being a clinical psychologist. I mean, it was never part of what I wanted to do, but of course, you know, it's a profession that's established. It's got prestige associated with it. But I have a clinical psychologist friend, and I said to him, you know, it might have a lot of prestige, but as IOs, we have a lot more potential in terms of our earnings. So that's the way I make sense of it. So of course, there it's not just about that, right? But it's a lot more. In fact, you know, like in the UK, IO psychology is the stepchild of psychology. And so I think as a Society of Industrial and Organizational Psychology, we're trying to position the profession within universities and of course within organizations. And if you think about some of our large organizations in South Africa, and I could probably extend that to global organizations because I've worked for global organizations. Mm-hmm. There's no such role as an IO psychologist in organizations, right? And so it's such a pivotal part of what we need in terms of understanding the work psychology, the behavioral science around what we do. And as I do this kind of supervision of interns in their registration to become full psychologists, and this is what I learned from my mentor, there's a distinct difference between what an IO psychologist does and what an HR person does. We understand the theory behind the process and practices. We understand the ethics behind the process and practices in a way that I think an HR practitioner does not understand. It doesn't mean that the one's better than the other, but there's a different role that we as IO psychologists play within the workplace.
Mm, absolutely. And I do think that distinction, it gets hazy because it's like, oh, well, you did occupational psychology or industrial organization, you just work in HR. And it's like, well, a lot of people are quite resistant to that who have studied IO psychology because they're like, that's not, if I wanted to do HR, I would have done HR. I don't want to do HR. So why can't I get a job in what I've studied? So it is quite, it's a catch 22, because there are a lot more roles in HR and organizational development and talent and all of those things. So it's hard to absorb all of the grads that come out with that real passion to want to apply the learning that they have just learned and spent a lot of money and time over. So hopefully there'll be more opportunities in both countries, because I do think it's a little bit, it can be quite disheartening for new graduates as well.
But if I could add to that, but it also affects the caliber and the type of individuals that then choose the career, because they don't see it as a first choice. And I think part of what we need to continue doing is to educate and to promote IO psychology as a preferred career path.
Absolutely.
And not as, like I've done, stumble across it because we didn't know any better.
So many people I've spoken to who even have done IO psychology are like, I didn't know anything about it until I was in my final year of undergraduate, or I stumbled across it when I was reading a book. Like, most psychologists don't know what IO psychology is, but a lot of IO psychologists, it's like, I applied to clinical, I didn't get on, or I didn't want to do clinical anymore, so I just did this. And it's like, okay, that's not a problem, you know, everyone's on a journey, but at the same time, where's the pipeline? Like, we've got to get a pipeline, get an interest, we've got to get people excited about it early on, so they already know what to expect to a certain extent. It's not a shock, it's not a surprise. And the opportunity to become quite successful and build a niche, I think there's much more of niche building in IO psychology as well as health. I think that's quite similar, and I suppose sports, of you can really just carve out what you want to do. That is if you do start your own businesses specifically as well, if you work as a contractor, or you can kind of do what you like the most as much as possible. And that's something unique, I think, to our route. One other question I've already written down, but I think you've already answered it, but I'm going to clarify, is the route to IO in South Africa. And it sounds like you do 3 years of a degree, then you top it up with the 1 year of the honours. And is that one, the honours part, is that where you specialise? How does it work?
So that 1 year of honours, you would select one subject, right? So you do, so I did industrial psychology for 1 year. So the kind of things I covered in that year, as I said earlier, so it's like consumer psychology, I did some organizational behavior, you do some research methodology, like any of these degrees. And so those personnel psychology, all of those kind of aspects. And remember, this was in the 90s, so we still called it personnel psychology. So then you specialize for the year, and then you do a master's degree, which is often 2 years,
right?
With a dissertation.
Yeah.
And then you do the PhD. So what you're finding a lot happening, and I've just, my current intern had done everything. So that would have been 3 years plus a year. So he had studied 7 years without any break, work experience.
Yeah.
And right. Now doing an internship. And so only after his internship would he go into his first role. Right. And so, you know, I don't know what's better, but for me, as you had alluded to earlier, when I got to an honors level, what I needed was work experience. Yeah. So I can make better sense of the knowledge that I was gaining through my education, because I had no clue what it meant to be employed. Although I did some casual work, you know, it's not the same as being employed in an organization where you have a role and, you know, it's a slightly different contract. And look, we're talking different times as well. Work has become a lot more fluid now. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was important to do that. But a lot of the young people and a lot of the interns that we're managing on this internship program have never worked before. Yeah. And so they don't have basic work readiness skills. And so a lot of the time is spent preparing them for work as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do. That does, it's echoed in a lot of countries, but it's definitely familiar. Do you have to do, in South Africa, can you finish the master's degree and then do the internship after the master's degree? Or is it encouraged that you do a PhD research?
No, so you can register for a psychologist with a master's degree. So you do what's referred to as your M1. So you do the coursework.
Yeah.
After your coursework, even if your internship's not done, even if your thesis is not done, you can actually start the internship.
Right.
And then after your internship, you write a board exam.
Oh, okay.
And you register with the Health Professions Council of South Africa, which governs all the health practitioners in South Africa.
Yeah.
And so the And so when I did mine, I did not have to write a board exam. For IOPs to complete their studies and to register, they need to write the board exam.
Right. I understand. That makes a lot of sense. And after you completed the master's degree, obviously there's a bit of a gap between that and the PhD as well. And so what did you do in between? That's like a long time.
So when I was a student, I worked as a cashier at this retail company that I eventually joined, as I told my story earlier.
Yeah.
And I spent 5 years with the retail company, left and went into consulting. I worked for KPMG, Ernst & Young. And so I wanted to go on my own. I wanted to create my own business. Because I was a registered psychologist, and the HR director then of the same retail company convinced me to come back as the executive organizational development. Right. And so I did that for 5 years. And part of the work we did there was understand what's the research around the different practices, or for example, talent management, understanding the psychology around it, the processes around it. And so that's one of the key signature processes that I implemented into that organization.
Right.
Looked at leadership models, what was the framework. So this is an organization that employed 30,000 people. So it's a large organization. And I was based at the head office responsible for organizational, executives responsible for organizational development. And so, for example, my team helped. I set up the team. I hired the individuals into the team. So we're a small team of about 3. And so we would then also, one of the key parts was we researched and developed the organizational leadership philosophy, the behaviors associated with it. So that was very interesting work. And then my boss asked me was the HR director, to move into learning and development.
Right.
And I remember moving into learning and development, and I asked one of the trainers, so how does this training fit into the strategy of the organization? And they're like, what do you mean strategy? We train, training has got nothing to do with strategy. And part of what I did in that role, I fused organizational development with learning and development, where you create organizational performance consultants as opposed to trainers. And really using my work around psychology, understanding around organizational development and learning, and to support the organization better. And so that's what I did for about 5 years. So you'll see my trajectory works in about 5 years, and I 5 years in and 5 years out. And so then I decided to go and start the business that I intended to start when I joined the retail company. And I joined an existing business. I was a shareholder. Okay. And we did some exciting work there. And then 5 years after that, I realized that I didn't have global experience. I've never really worked, although I worked for EY and Ernst & Young and KPMG, it was not really, I didn't have a global role.
Mm.
And so at that time, I joined the Coca-Cola company.
Right.
I was responsible for talent development for South Africa. Okay. And by the time I left there, I was the talent lead for Eurasia Africa.
Mm.
And the regions that include Eastern Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And we were responsible for the talent and the development of the talent within the region. Mm. And so that's the point when I'd been busy with my PhD for a couple of years then.
Yeah.
And this was an intense job. I traveled to the Middle East often, to Dubai. I traveled to Atlanta often. And I really, what I call, created this weekend PhD, which every weekend I would work on it. So the Saturday, I would try and remember what I did this last Sunday. By the Sunday, I remembered what I did, and then I had to go work again, And I had to make a decision to follow this path with the Coca-Cola company or do my PhD. And so I resigned my job. And literally within a year, rewritten the total, all my chapters again, and submitted it at the end of the year. And of course, I finished it successfully.
Fantastic. I think that crossroads of like, I could do two things, but those are people that have done a PhD by research, or are a professional, it's extremely hard to juggle a full-time and yours was a very demanding full-time job with a PhD, because a PhD is another full-time job on top of it. Even if you're doing it part-time, it's a full-time job. So it sounds like you, I mean, that was the right decision for you at the time. I can't imagine traveling, doing all that traveling, coming back on the weekend exhausted, and then having to like look at literature reviews and statistics and coding, because you were coding it all, of transcripts. Oh gosh, no.
I think it's bringing all of that kind of trauma back again. Yeah, absolutely. It was hard to do, and I think it was the right decision.
Yeah.
It set up and opened up a new path for me, you know, which I'm really loving at the moment, because I'm doing the work that I enjoy.
Mm.
I'm writing a book around authenticity at work. It's like an albatross. It feels like another PhD.
I've written a thesis.
It's very different writing. And so I've written 8 chapters. So what I've done is I've asked people to write their own stories, Black professionals.
Right.
And, you know, talking about their experiences and, of course, their identification in the workplace and the extent to which they can be themselves and the things that get in the way. And what are the tools and the strategies and tactics that they use to cope in the world of work today. And so I'm almost done. I've got 2 more chapters to finish, but you know, work always gets in the way. So I'm going to have to take some time out to just finish those last two chapters.
So funny. This sounds a very familiar story, I'm not going to lie. I don't know what it is about IO psychologists or psychologists in general that I know, but I think it's like, you never have just one job. You're doing a job, you're doing a side job, and you're probably doing some voluntary jobs at the same time. Like, it's very interesting to hear this. So again, that book sounds fantastic. Again, feel free when it's released to share it with me. I'll share it around, because I think I had a similar idea, but I've never done it. I think that's what these podcasts are about. It is the same thing. It's just that I don't have to write anything. So it's great. I just have to edit a podcast once and then it's done. So yeah, definitely capturing the stories, coping mechanisms and all of those things is something that sounds really useful. So you said earlier, before we didn't capture it on the recording, but you said that you have your own consultancy as well as you work academically as well. So can you just tell me a little bit more about that and how you juggle both of them?
So I can relate to, you know, you're talking about these multiple you know, kind of gigs that we have as individuals. And so I've definitely become a gig worker in so many ways. And so I run the consulting business. I have one intern that works for me full time.
Right.
And I have a network of people that I work with. So depending on the kind of size of the projects, I'll pull individuals into the project. And so that's the one part of what I do. And then the second part is the academic part, where I teach at the Africa Leadership School of Business. Mm-hmm. I teach leadership.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what's amazing about the work that we do there, it's got a Pan-African perspective.
Brilliant.
And we've got the most amazing students across the African continent, and with the same objective to create a better Africa, and create ethical entrepreneurial leadership. And so that's the one part of my job, and then, or my gig, I suppose, if I can call it that. And then I also, I supervise, to keep my foot in industrial organizational psychology, I supervise master's students for their internships and also for their master's degrees.
Yeah.
And so that's, in that way, I stay grounded in IOP, industrial organizational psychology, so that's the other part I do. And for, of course, like you say, I also am a board member on a NGO where we're helping schools. And the one school that we're working with is one of the underperforming schools in South Africa, in Gauteng, the region that I live in.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to help the school. We've done some assessments, numeracy and literacy assessments.
Right.
We brought in a provider. We're probably also going to do some leadership alignment work with the school leadership team, bringing the IO psychology into that conversation, and also career and counseling and guidance of the school. It's an underprivileged area,
mm-hmm.
And it's an underperforming school. Only 40% of the matriculants, which is the last year of school, past matric. And so this is something, this is a school that that we work with. And then of course, from a professional perspective, as I said earlier, I'm also on the board for the Society of Industrial Psychology, looking at looking after transformation of the society to create a more diverse pool of psychologists, create a more inclusive climate so that we can change the profession to represent the communities that we live in.
Put your hands full then.
Yep, never dull moment.
That sounds great, especially I like hearing about the school that you're working with. That does sound really interesting. And I think that's paralleled throughout the world. You do get underperforming schools and they usually tend to be in deprived areas as well. I just did inverted commas there with deprived areas. So it sounds like bringing the IO psychology into certain industries that they might not have had exposure to. I love that because, I mean, we've all been to school. Some people have had exposure to school. If you're a parent or some, you know, I know teachers, and sometimes I listen to teacher stories, like my brother's a teacher, my dad used to be a teacher, friends and family members are teachers, and I'm just like, oh my goodness, they really need an intervention or five. They need to do some psychometrics, do some team building, all sorts of stuff. So I think IO psychology and education, but especially primary, secondary and tertiary education, that's a really interesting area of growth. I hope that more educational establishments really utilize that as a tool, because I think it's definitely needed. So it'd be interesting to hear more about that as you go forward.
Can I share something doing at the moment?
Yeah.
So we're currently working with an organization that looks after youth development in South Africa. South Africa's got about a 40% unemployment rate of our youth.
Yeah.
And so what they do is they place youth in schools to support the schools in terms of just general administration, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're doing at the moment as SOYOPSA is that we're working with this organization to see whether we can take some of our interns and get them work exposure in the schools.
Yeah.
Now, according to the Health Professions Council, the students have to, the interns have to cover certain hours.
Yeah.
And often, you know, with the kind of economy that we have at the moment, not many organizations are taking in interns.
Right.
And so these schools could be a place where they could do some of the hours around career guidance, counseling, skills, psychometric assessments.
Yeah.
And so we're exploring that. And so in fact, we'll place probably five students this year, but I'm having another conversation with another organization which is outside of the province where I'm in at the moment, to see whether we can go nationally. And so we could take IO interns from other universities that can partner with these organizations, so that we can support the schools in South Africa. So that's an exciting project.
Really exciting.
It's kind of in its kind of embryo, you know, kind of the beginning stages. And so I'll keep you informed with the progress that we're making.
Yes, please. My next question is, and we've touched upon it already, but I'd like to ask a standalone question around it. So as an IO psychologist, as you've been practicing since around, was it 2002, I suppose, how have your multiple identities really impacted your experience at work? And obviously you can only speak from a subjective point of view per se, but it will be interesting to hear of somebody in South Africa that is of various groups that are marginalized, what your experiences of work have been. Obviously you've been really successful educationally and professionally, but that's at the end per se, but what's happened in between, what shaped your experiences?
I think, you know, as I was, my PhD was instrumental in terms of the work that I needed to do, because I wrote an autoethnography, which is something I published and which I will send to you to read as well. And so the autoethnography was really just understanding who am I, where am I at work, can I be myself, and what's the consequences of my authenticity, which was my research, the questions I asked in my research.
Right.
And having to do the work that I was doing to others, to myself, and writing the narrative of my own story and understanding the insights that I got to. And so narrative work is so important. as we, you know, in terms of creating the self-awareness. And that was a that was an important journey for me that I had to go through. And as I was reflecting, as I was doing some memory work around certain incidences, I suddenly realized the extent of the microaggression, the oppression. And for me, it was an odd kind of experience, but I couldn't put my hand on it. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing my analysis of these stories, I realized how that impacted who I was. And what I then started doing is creating this shield to protect myself. Mm-hmm. And I created this hard exterior not to show people who I am, mm-hmm. because I was afraid of being you know, marginalized, being ostracized, not being included. And being an homosexual man, also creating these kind of heterosexual norms and values of being tough. And one of the things that important insights that I got to through my analysis of my autoethnography is that the impression management strategies that I use, and let me explain that. Yeah. So when I got, say 10 years ago, I started growing dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. I had them for 5 years. I loved having them. And I cut them about 8 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And when I was reflecting on that, my dreadlocks became part of what I created, this impression I created of toughness and exterior that I created so that, you know, and I confuse people, right? And so I walk into the boardroom and I have a suit with dreadlocks and they're like, this doesn't gel, right? But that was a way of protecting my self-esteem, right? My fragile self-esteem of being battered and stigmatized over a long period of time. And that realization is to just be proudly me. And part of what the story I write and I'll share a link to my blog as well. I'm not my hair, you know, I'm more than my hair, right? And so, and I particularly our female colleagues experience this a lot more than what males do, black males. But that was part of my experience of creating this exterior, the strategies I use. And so part of the book that I write, part of the work that I do is making individuals, marginalized individuals or minorities aware of the strategies that they use to protect themselves and the consequences of those strategies. Patricia Yulin has done research around how marginalized and black individuals create a facade of conformity in the terminology that she created, and where we pretend to fit in, but we don't really conform. But we pretend to conform, right? And that pretense create over a period of time affects our psychological well-being, and so it affects our work performance, and so the work that I do is about allowing people to express themselves, to be their best self, the best that they can be. And this is where the authentic identity work comes in as well. How do we construct an authentic self using our multiple identities to configure what will make the best selves that we want to be?
That's so interesting. And I really like that, how you use those terms around pretending to conform. I'm not going to expose myself too much in this podcast episode, but that's very relatable to me. I'm like, oh, I'll just do what I have to do. I don't really want to do it, but I need to keep this job, so I'm just going to do it. I'll whinge about it at home, but everyone at work, it will just get done eventually. So and this is where you're talking about that it does affect the person's self-esteem, and it erodes the extent of, like, you're a shell of yourself. So that is that is based on being incongruent. You're not being true to yourself, and you're having to do this stuff every day, and you come home and you're just like, I hate it. I don't how do I get back to who I am and where I want to be? And it's also a level of cognitive dissonance, because you're like, it doesn't add up. Like, I don't want to be this person. But a lot of the time you end up playing this role for so long, you don't realize what's happening until, I suppose, the end of your career, or if you had the realization early on, you're just like, I need to leave. I mean, you don't know where you're going, but you just know that you can't stay there. So interesting. So thank you for sharing that. I think that really does, obviously, that's the whole point of what you do in your consultancy, that authenticity. And I was having this conversation actually at work about what does belonging really mean, because a lot of people use it like, oh, you know, a lot of in the UK, a lot of diversity inclusion roles, it's now diversity inclusion and belonging, that's the job title. But most people would just be like, well, that doesn't make any sense, what do you mean by belonging? But actually it's like, can I come to work and know no matter what I represent that I'm going to be treated fairly based on who I am and not reprimanded for, like you said, having dreadlocks at work with a suit? Like, are people going to be confused by that? Why are they confused?
Mm-hmm.
So those, you know, microaggressions, are they going to come out of the water cooler? Are they going to come out when, you know, you turn on your Microsoft Teams video and your hairstyle is different and how many comments you get about that, you know? So thank you for sharing that. It's really fantastic. So it just sounds like you're interested as well as how people can navigate their different identities at work. So your coping mechanisms around conforming sometimes, I'm assuming that setting up your own business, I suppose, is a way of coping with what you had to deal with when you were employed.
But also equipping others to think about the identity work that we do, the repairing, the strengthening of who we are in a more conscious way. You know, it's not part of contemporary kind of organizational processes. And so what I'd like to do is to get this into organizations, get people to understand what identity work is, how do we construct who we are, how do we configure the multiple identities, what strategies we use, and the implication if we're using integration strategies versus differentiation strategies versus, you know, balancing strategies versus impression management strategies on the other side, or acculturation, or all of these terms that we know exist within the literature, but we've not made it practical for the ordinary person to understand and make sense of. And so that's my objective, and it's a struggle. I'm not there where I can explain it yet in a simplistic way that can help an individual navigate that. But I think we should not get to the end of our careers and then figure this out.
No.
We should help these young individuals to understand that these are the context in which you operate will have various triggers or threats.
Yeah.
And we need to build capacity and also capabilities, particularly for those that feel marginalized in organizations, to deal with these threats in a more positive way. And how do we then construct who we are and have a positive sense of who we are? And if I could share just the results from my survey, or the findings from my survey, what I found, those that were incongruent or inauthentic or not able to be themselves, what we found was that they often had a low self-esteem, some of the themes that emerge, or they have a high contingent self-esteem, which means that it's contingent on someone validating me, right? Low productivity, intend to leave, mistrustful social relations, and often poor progression, career progression in organizations as well. So these have kind of severe negative effects on those that feel marginalized. Of course, this is not generalizable to all, contexts, but this is within the context of multinational organizations, and particularly looking at Black individuals and in these organizations.
Absolutely. It sounds like a blinded piece of research. Again, it's not so much in specific contexts around that. If you do a lit review, trying to find, it's a lot of American-based research, but even still, it's not as on the nose as that. It's not as specific. So I'm really excited for when that comes out. So we're coming towards the end, unfortunately, but I'd love to hear your advice, because obviously you deal with IO psychologists all the time in your supervision work, and you deal with undergraduates and postgraduates when you do your lecturing piece as well. But what advice would you give to people who are aspiring IO psychologists?
Perhaps I want to take it IO psychologists and also those that feel marginalized in the context of work, right? Because I wish that I knew that I needed to do the work earlier, on myself, and I had the skills to do the work. And that just takes time. Every time I think I have the answer, another window opens and we need to start doing the work again. And so I think it's important that we have to do the work ourselves. I can give an example of a coaching client who is a queer woman in the context in the workplace.
Yeah.
And she was not prepared to do the work. And my advice then at that point is that let's separate our way, let's separate our paths, and let you go do the work. And then when you're ready, let's then connect again and I can help you. But if you're not prepared to do the work, you're not going to progress. And so it's about the willingness to do the work. And I want to encourage particularly our young IOPs to really do the work on themselves, understand themselves in that way. And it takes time. I find, particularly with our young IOPs, what we refer to them as emerging IOPs in South Africa, is that they're impatient. They want to get it done tomorrow. It does take time. I also find that, and this is our own personal lesson, and I find it more and more as I'm supervising students and interns, is to pay attention to the detail. Mm-hmm. It's important, right? I find that we often gloss over the details because there's no shortcut.
Right.
It's going to take you a year. You need to do the hours. You need to do your time, right? And okay. So also that, to be your best at all times. I would often say to interns that I work with, students that I work with, is this the best work that you were able to produce? Are you proud of the work that you produce? Because I'm now to protect you. Next time when you step into the workplace, it's not going to be as coaching and comfortable as this conversation. It's going to be a lot. The consequences may be more severe for you. So it's really about doing your best at all times. And I find that if I also knew the power of social networks better earlier in my career and connecting, and you asked me the question and I couldn't think of any Black IOP while I was doing my intern, and I wish I'd gone out and found them because I'm sure they were there, right? I just didn't know where to look for them.
I mean, in those days, there was no social media, so it would have been a lot harder.
it was a bit of the Stone Age, right? So I wish I'd done more of that. And lastly, I think, as I think about work and the work we do in IOP, the notion of following one path,
yeah,
I think is no longer going to be. And that's we talk about gig work, and I think part of IOP is going to be driven by this kind of gig work that we do, particularly the work that I do. You're going to have multiple, we know that the future world of work, we talk about individuals that could even have multiple, work for multiple organizations,
yeah,
and then be employed with them. Like, I'm a consultant, so I do work for multiple organizations, but that's likely to be what the model could be like. And so this boundaryless career perspective,
yeah,
is going to be a critical part of how we shape who we are as individuals.
I love how you brought in a boundaryless career, because that's what my PhD was about, boundaryless career and protean career. So thank you for making that relevant right at the end. We've gone full circle. So thank you. I think all of that is really great advice, especially as painful as it sounds, but doing your best at all times, even if you don't really feel like it, connecting and networking as much as you can, and really focusing on the details. But that's more about how relevant things are and looking at finding the things that no one else is really paying attention and trying to figure out why that is. I think that's, mm-hmm, also the case. It doesn't always have to be like crossing every T and dotting every I.
Sure.
It can, sure, be like thinking a little bit more abstractly. But I think sometimes that's not really rewarded in the workplace. It's a bit, absolutely, more like, get the work done and move on. Why are you ruminating on like this is a matter? But I suppose that's where you can really differentiate yourself. Like, everyone can do the work. That's why you're employed. But actually, what else are you bringing? Like, what's your angle? What's your perspective? Why should people care about it? And I think that's a really good piece of advice, especially for early careers. I think if that's honed in a little bit more, then the individuality really can bring itself out when you feel a bit more confident. A lot of people think, oh, I'll do that when I'm more established, because it's too much. It's a quite a bit of a risk to do early on in your career. But at the same time, you have us. I'm going to say you've got less to lose, but why not take a risk?
Absolutely. And I wish more young people would do that. Right. And that's why I think we as more senior IOPs, and I really believe in this, can make it easier for those that come behind us.
Yeah, absolutely.
We often see within this work as well, You know, when an individual get to the top of their careers, they kick the ladder away and they say, find your own path. And instead of creating the possible pathways that individuals can be, can go or take to be their best selves. And so that's an underlying philosophy of who I am and what the businesses that I run, which is Authentic Organizations.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much. I will add all of the links in when, you know, when you, when you're ready to give them to me. So anyone can find you either on LinkedIn and connect. Are you happy for people to do that?
Absolutely.
As sure. Well as, you know, look at your website, have a look at some of the books that you've written as well. So thank you so much for your time this evening, all the way from South Africa. Like I said, I do wish I was in South Africa and not southeast of England right now. But, you know, we can only wish. But yeah, thank you so much for your time.